Welcome to the Tiny Plastic People podcast, the podcast about tiny plastic people. We paint them, we play with them, and we warm their cool-blooded lizardy bodies. I am dying
in our ovens.
In our ovens, yeah. All right. That's a pretty deep take.
Yeah, I'm not someone who says I don't often say people are doing their hobby wrong, but
you might
be doing your hobby wrong.
All right. Well, this is the tone we're going to set the rest of this podcast.
Are you familiar with this anecdote?
Well, we'll come back to this, right? So this is before I am personally attacked. Dines being personally attacked by Tom.
Tom F. Tomfield. Hello, that's me.
Yeah. Hey, and also Tom.
Hello, this is Tom G, also known as Respectable Geek.
Yeah, and Rachel.
Hello, I'm not Tom.
A trifecta of tumultuous Toms.
That's all I'm bringing to this podcast.
is your lack of Tom name. Mm-hmm. So, great. Thanks.
The prophesied assembly of Toms, which we have been dreading for 25 podcasts, has now occurred.
We've got our notes as well.
Happened before.
We got Tom F, we got Tom G, and we haven't got Tom H with us.
Ah!
We could, in fact, have Tom H in theory.
Yeah, so listener, if you get confused by this one, just think it could be even worse.
Yeah. join us in the confusion. Anyway. So, Tom, I'll tell you what, let's start the easy way. Rachel, how's your hobby gone?
It's been a slow hobby month. For various reasons, I have only painted one squad, which is...
Well, how big is the squad?
Well, it's 10? 11 models, technically. It's a Guardian squad, which is the first bit of 40k that I've ever painted.
A future Warhammer?
A future Warhammer. It will never catch on.
Yeah, what's dragged you to future Warhammer?
Well, so, I mean, technically... Eldar were my first collection when I was little, but of course I never painted them because I was 11 or 12 or whatever, and then due to unfortunate parental accident they were recycled.
Ouch. Rest in peace.
Yeah. And then, so I've been dreaming about painting some Eldar for ages. And since I got back into the hobby, I've been like, okay, one of these years, I'm going to paint some Eldar. And then people got sick of me threatening to paint Eldar and told me to go and do it. So I got a squad, I painted them, and I think they've come out really nicely.
Do you enjoy painting them? Is it differ from swords and boards?
Does it differ?
They've got
fancy guns.
Laser guns.
I guess like...
In every other way, it's exactly the same.
Yeah, they've got some different stuff going on, I guess. But like, I didn't like do anything. And, like, I guess when I based them, I could have done some like, I don't know, stuff you wouldn't see in fantasy, like... barbed wire or something, but I couldn't be bothered. It's been like I've painted the squad and it took me an entire month, but I think in total I spent like maybe 5 or 6 hours on them because it's just been such a slow hobby month for various reasons. It's dreadful. But I have played some games, but maybe we can cycle back around to games.
Nice. Well, that's interesting. Tom F?
Sure. So what I have been doing, last time I was on the podcast was, we recorded before Christmas and it came out afterwards, maybe?
The way of things.
It's embarrassing to say it like that. Maybe I should have phrased it differently. And since then I have... So some of us on the Role Models Discord have been doing a New Year, New Army project. And for that, I decided to do the Tau that have been sat in my cupboard since February last year.
Wow.
And since the start of the year, I've painted about 1,500 points of them.
Wow, that's a really good game.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty pleased with how they've come out. They've got a nice bright orange, and I think they look pretty good.
Is that a canon set, or is it something you made up?
It's just something I made up. This is like the third time in a row that I've played around with my own color schemes and ended up at orange.
Well, it's strong. Color. It's certainly the colour of jumper I'm wearing right now. So, a good choice, I say.
We have that thing in common.
Yeah.
I have a lot of affection for the town models because they are, more than most, I think they are little guys. And I have a theory as to why.
Oh.
The Fire Warriors are a bit smaller than... So the Fire Warriors are like the basic infantry, and they're a bit smaller than most other basic infantry sets. Mm. So they are little enough to be little.
They're smaller than the Votan, right?
I would say they're pretty comparable.
Yeah, they must be, right?
The Tau are ironically squatting a little bit. Mm. But so I think they are similar sizes. They are definitely way less stocky.
Yeah, I suppose.
So the Fire Warriors are little enough to be little, and the Crisis suits are big enough to be guys, so they really are all little guys to me.
Yeah, I suppose scale creep over the years would result in that. I mean, because the Tau models are... is it still the same Fire Warrior set as when they first released?
Or... It looks very, very similar, but it's been updated.
Yeah, I think...
But I think possibly the update happened before the more recent... upscaling of stuff, because I think the upscaling really started
early 2010s
for the Fire Warriors.
Yeah,
and I think the upscaling really started in earnest with 8th edition with the Space Marine, primarily Space Marines, and then since then, the guards have changed significantly in their scaling since then.
Yeah, for sure.
I think there's some. Some of the kits before then as well, with the... I'm thinking specifically of the Death Watch and the newer Chaos Marines, the Thousand Suns.
Mm. Oh, yeah, okay.
Those are a little taller.
How did GCL Cults compare? Because they were in the tens, weren't they, when they came out?
So they're about the same era, right? They were the same time as the Death Watch. So I haven't actually ever sat down and put one next to Acadian, but my brain is telling me a little bit taller.
So truly the whittlest guys.
Yeah.
So I mean, I feel at some point we need to just go to our collections and just get a model from every year that we can find. And just have them in a line, a theoretical human-sized model, and see how the scale changes and whether there's a gradual increase or a massive jump.
Mm.
But
I think it's gradual. I think it's happening.
Yeah,
that's a whole other thing. That's a whole discussion on how scale has creeped.
It's almost a change in fashion or a change in style, right?
I think it is, though.
I don't want to make it sound frivolous, like at some point they're going to go back, right? I think this is a very considered thing, and like, okay, the best way to get the effect we are trying to get is such and such, and both the capacity to achieve that effect and precisely what effect they're going for changes over time.
Yeah, right? I think it's an intentional change in style, I think, which is gradually cutting. Because you look at some of the old metal models, even the like Warhammer Fantasy Battle ones, and they are micro compared to some of the stuff now. It's wild. Yes. It's wild.
Yeah, because I feel there's always been scale creep from, as you say, from the original metal models to the plastics. I feel that it possibly is much more deliberate now, because it feels like a conscious choice, and I think there's been a lot of challenging assumptions about how things should work in terms of model making and rules making from Games Workshop over the last 5 years or so, maybe a bit longer than that, and that this is part of that of, okay, it's the same thing as the, why are we using 6-foot by 4-foot tables all the time? Mm. Is that the right choice?
And yes.
And I like to think there's a lot of thinking for a lot of aspects of how they work. Is this the right choice, or could we do better? Is it the right choice to have our human models be this tool with massively oversized hands and weapons, or is there a set of dimensions which we prefer?
Mm. Yes.
Mm.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. And all that just from a little, just from the whittlest guys. It's a whole lot.
Just little guy.
They're just
They've
little
got
guys.
Hooves.
They've got. They're just little goat guys.
I think if
fish.
You want to be weird about it, they're one of the very few kits in the range that have bare feet.
Yeah, that is weird. But... that is weird.
like specifically bare feet and no other skin showing. Shall we move on?
Yeah,
Tom,
let's
see. What have you been doing?
Well, in terms of painting and modelling, not a lot, to be honest. I mean, I think I was asked on the podcast also before Christmas, and I've been in a bit of a... I don't want to call it a hobby slump, because it's not been a... oh, I really don't want a hobby. I've just somehow not managed to find time where I've sat down and done hobby. I think I've, in that time, I've maybe finished painting one Stormcast over the last several months, which was just a bit of a dry brush. I've got quite a lot of things which are sort of half done. I've put some more paint on my knights. I have, in fact, I've actually managed to go backwards on my Imperial Knights, because I've taken the shoulder pads off my Imperial Knights and ordered new shoulder pads so I can repaint them. So my Imperial Knights, I had glued a whole load of skulls on them and shields, and it was, and I decided I didn't like that aesthetic anymore.
Why
sort of,
would you do this?
Yeah. Skulls are so last year.
Yeah, it's sort of it just wasn't
working.
What is
this, the year 40,002?
Yeah, it's so passé. So I mean, really...
so 40,008. I'd say. Yeah. 40,008. Fuck, I garbled that. Carry on.
That's good.
Yeah, I mean, really, the mistake I made when gluing them on was I didn't file the back of the skulls down. So I just, if I had sort of cut the backs of the skulls off and glued them flat, that would have worked a lot better. Mm. As it was, it was just skulls glued on there, quite arbitrarily, and I didn't feel they were looking, because I wasn't going to do that with the armatures that I've got now, and I was starting to include much more in the way of individual heraldry on my knights. I thought, actually, I'd like to have the shoulder pads to have some more individual heraldry on them and a bit more patterning on them.
Not and just the skulls.
Yeah, exactly. And the skulls were just in the way of that, and and having some quite consistent transfers between the knights I've got as well. Because I quite like the on the knight's sheet, there's a skull in a cog, the old Mechanica symbol. I really like that. And what I'm doing on my knights now is having that on one half, and then half an Imperial Eagle on the other half. So it's sort of got both Mechanicus and Imperial on there. And I'm actually painting over the cog bits, so because the aesthetic of my knights is all very skull-like. Mm. And I was trying to say, oh, can I just clip these skulls off and repaint it? But I was actually, these shoulder pads are already quite damaged. So I just went to eBay and ordered some new ones, which also has the advantage of allowing me to take the arms off. And I'm planning to, because I'd magnetised the arms.
Oh, right.
But I didn't do particularly well with magnetising the arms. So they're all quite wobbly. So what I'm thinking I'm probably possibly going to do is go to one of these sites where you can get sort of casts or models of the shoulder joints, and leave the shoulder pads glued off, and be able to, and have each arm be on its own shoulder joint, and just plug it in there. And it's just sort of, it's been quite nice, sort of a, how is this project evolving so I can be happy with it? But it is a bit of a faff of going, actually, I've gone backwards on this. I think also I've put some... I've not rebased them, but I have put a load of snow on their bases now, so they're now in a much more snowy situation. And at some point, I will actually finish this Knight Army and then do a Chaos Knight Army.
It doesn't sound like you've gone backwards. It sounds like there's some, you go with the flow, right? It's evolved, and what you wanted is now different from what you wanted then.
You're moving the end result forward.
Hmm. Yeah, there is less paint on the models than there was at the start of the year.
Yeah, but it's closer now to what you want it to be.
Yeah, so that's my hobby. I've been thinking about scenery a lot and other stuff, but...
Yeah, we'll come to that.
Yeah, but haven't... Yeah, nice. Haven't finished much recently, which every weekend I think, maybe I'll finish it this weekend, and then I end up really busy and don't do anything. So,
So it's been a while since I've been on as well. I can't remember the last time, towards the end of last year, maybe. I have not done a huge amount. I've also been, and I will call it a hobby slump. I moved house and then things get difficult when you have to unpack and blah 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 blah. That was six months ago now, so I'm running out of excuses. I did start painting one especially old dead frog. I've turned him into sub assemblies. This is Croak, topically.
Oh yeah.
I don't want to criticize your hobbying, but getting frogs from the garden and painting them is
you got to commit, haven't you? Really?
Yeah.
So I painted the mummified frog from the garden, not really. And I painted his skink friend, his chair. His chair is so challenging. It's so complicated. And I thought, I'll come to this, right? But I thought Croak's chair was complicated, and it is. But oh my lord, the new Slan chair is something else. But anyway, it's very difficult because it's very full of nooks and crannies. But I'm getting there. Painting this sort of giant spinny bits around the chair, that was really good fun. I need to just finish him off because there's a new wave of cool, cold-blooded, cool guys coming in. But yeah, that's about it really. That's what I've really managed to tackle is most of Croak. I need to finish him off. But yeah, it's been good. So one of the things you want to talk about, you mentioned Tom. Which Tom is the terrain? So what did you want to? You want to talk about modular terrain?
Oh, did we want to talk about games played first?
Oh well, go on then. Yeah, I actually played some games as well, and they were pretty good. I played Boarding Actions; it was really nice, and I hope that the new 40K is like that because it was wicked cool. But anyway, that's literally all I've got to say. Go on. Let's talk about some games.
Given I raised the topic, while I haven't been doing much painting, I have been playing quite a lot of games. So I've been playing a Necromunda campaign over the last few months. I think I've mentioned it previously on the podcast. We're planning to do our big finale this weekend, so that'd be fun. And a lot of playing my Orlocks and having a lot of fun just having a regular campaign going on that. What I've also been playing, and I'm particularly keen on, I've finally, after years of thinking, this looks like a game I will really enjoy and really like, I finally played Warcry for the first time. And I was right. I really enjoy it. I really like it. I think it's a great game. And I am keen to start playing more of it because it really feels that niche for me of quick to play. You don't care too much if a game goes south because it's quite quick to do, and there's a whole load of variety in what you can do with your warbands in the sort of options available, and just the idea of having cards to draw for your scenario and your twist and your setup just really appeals to me as a way of keeping things fresh. So I'm a massive fan of Warcry now.
Another combat. It's a very good rule set, to be honest. For other people as well, it strikes a really nice balance of the sort of the complexity, but also some complexity of a small skirmish war game, but then also not being incredibly in depth and having quite the granularity of something like Necromunda. And it's really solid. Glad you finally had a chance to play it.
Playing Necromunda and Warcry in the same week sometimes really
that's gonna screw with your head.
It really emphasises the differences between the two systems. I love both the systems, but Necromunda, I think is an acquired taste.
That's it. Yes.
Interesting way of putting it.
I don't think I have that taste.
Yeah, I think Necromunda is similar to Heresy, a game that you have to be very cautious about recommending, because even if you love it, a route to loving it is knowing it well. So it can both be tricky games to recommend, because a part of what you're recommending is if you put a bunch of time into this and play a shit ton of games without really knowing why you're losing them, after that it becomes fantastic.
Like learning to ride a bike. You get a lot of scraped knees on the way, but at the end you're going to have a great time.
Necromunda is learning to ride a bike while it's on fire and someone keeps... And you're not quite sure how many wheels it's supposed to have, or if they're the right wheels.
And sometimes the wheels just fall off because you roll the bad dice.
My Necromunda experience, I'm not sure whether I just learned to play the game better or whether it just perked up, because in this campaign I got the ability to bring a guy with a melter gun out from any board edge at basically any time. So, like, I was still an idiot who didn't know what I was doing, but one of the things I was reliably clown shooting my way into was completely frying one person per turn.
Bringing a melter gun to a knife fight.
Yep,
absolutely. Like, you just pop up around a corner and deal three insta dead kills to one person, and just apologize to a former friend as they take their favorite model and throw it across the room.
Yeah, it's vaporizing one model per turn.
Exactly.
Well, that's pretty savage. I think I've literally never... I think I have never played New Necromunda. I've played a version of it, but I've never played it. And I think that's okay.
Yeah, I think Necromunda is a game that needs curating. Mm. And it needs people to go in there knowing what sort of experience they want to have from the campaign. So I'm enjoying it. And we are planning to have another campaign once this one finishes. But as part of that, we currently have a several page long list of proposed house rules.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, if that lets you arrive at a game you can enjoy, then that's good, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Nice. Anybody else played any notable games?
You first. No. Tom?
No, absolutely. Oh. You wanted to start the topic. You go ahead.
I guess we... Yeah, I'll just... So, I played a bit of Warcry. We've got a little, like, Warcry group in the office now, and some days after work, we play some Warcry, which is very nice.
That's the dream.
It is the dream. Sorry, I've just noticed one of my paint pots is slightly open. Oh, God.
Don't let that happen on
it. I must sort this before... There we go. Okay. Disaster averted. And played a couple games. Well, a few games of Age of Sigmar for the local sort of semi-competitive league. And I've also played my first games of Kings of War. Kings of War Armada, which is a boat game.
Boats.
Why are they more angry?
Fucking hell. That took a second.
Sorry.
Yeah. Am I supposed to just move on?
Can we address what just happened? And that was very funny, Tom. Just want to stake that. But how are both the Kings of War?
So Kings of War, for people who aren't aware, is a sort of rank and flank style mass battle game of the sort. It's the sort of game that Warhammer Fantasy Battle was, where you have big blocks of infantry and they move in formation and they wheel around and they charge each other's flanks and rears and that sort of thing. But it's really streamlined. You you don't remove models when a unit takes damage, which lets you do something called multi-basing, where if you've got a unit of goblins, they can all just go on the same big...
One big base.
Yeah, one big hunk of MDF. Mm. So you can do little dioramas if you want to. So I've got a 750-point ogre army, which has some ogres, because they made some new plastic ogre sculpts recently. And a little unit of goblins to fill out 70 points in it. And me and another local who has some dwarfs agreed to play, and we took ages to actually get together and play the game, and we finally did. And it turns out it's a lot of fun. It's just like, it plays really smoothly. There's definitely like a lot of complexity in how units move around, not at like the basic level. It's just when things get complicated, like you've got like lots of units kind of crammed into a small space, that you have to like open up the page that has all the diagrams showing you how to navigate this weird this sort of ballet of rectangles
crashing units.
But I guess that's where all the complexity should be in a game that's just about moving units around. Like otherwise, like when you want to attack, you roll to hit, and then you roll to damage, and that's it.
What are there like modifiers for how you've managed to?
There's modifiers. So like your to damage roll is based on what you're attacking, and you might have like the equivalent of armor piercing or something like that that lets you lower the target number of that roll. And then like things don't, like a unit doesn't die when it runs out of hit points. You still have to make what's called a nerve roll. Basically, if a unit takes damage at the end of that like phase, you have to roll a dice, you know, you have to roll 2d6, and if it's above a certain value, that unit is wavering, so it's like kind of taken battle shock. And if it's above its right value, then it's gone from the table. And it's kind of like, it's just like, it's quite abstract, but it means there's kind of like a bit of tension in like sure, I may have dealt quite a lot of damage, but there's a chance it sticks around, because if you roll a double one on the nerve test, it doesn't run away. Like it might be in like a weakened state. So if you're above your right value in terms of how much damage you've taken, then you're devastated, even if you're still on the table, I think. But anyway, it's just like, it plays really quickly. And even though we were playing really small games, I can see how it scales up really well to much bigger games. Like, it didn't feel like there was anything in the rules that would slow down a larger points game. Nice. And that's like really inviting to me. And yeah, I can't wait to play more. Yeah. I've ordered a giant to put in my army for our next game.
Yeah, it sounds really different to anything I've ever played. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah,
it sounds to me like the sort of, it addresses a lot of the problems I have with a lot of games of, rank and flank, and as you say, being able to put models on large bases and having dioramas feels like that's a thing you want to be able to do if you've got large square units. You want to be able to do something fun with them rather than just having removing a goblin at a time sort of thing, which is the frustration with Warhammer Fantasy. And also that thing of they're not destroyed, you have to make the nerve check. It feels like a good way of making sure you get to play with your toys. Because one of the things that I always find quite frustrating and in games is when a thing gets removed straight away and you haven't really got a chance to use it.
Your new model syndrome.
Yeah. And
yeah, it sounds like this is really abstracting it out to huge... It sounds sort of total war-y, sort of you're abstracting into giant units of things, right? So, you know, it can take a huge load of damage, but they're still there. You've still got like 15 goblins in.
There's still enough of them there. Like you don't until you're devastated, you're still gonna roll the same number of attacks. when you hit back.
How many sort of goblins do you have on a bed? What's the scale, by the way?
It's 28 mil scale.
Oh wow! So
it's the same as Warhammer Fantasy, big, yeah. Really. Mm-hmm. But because it's like it's just about the footprint of the units. Like if you really wanted to, you could technically play it at like 10 mil scale and just have like really big blocks of infantry on a big base. Anyway, other game, Kings of War Armada, is the boat game.
Boats.
And it's got a lot more going on than Kings of War, I think, just in terms of like the complexity of just playing it. But I think once you've got the basics down, it's quite straightforward. And all you need to do at that point is refer back to the tables for how much you modify your shooting dice by when you're shooting at something that's more than 10 inches away.
So it kind of has gunnery tables.
A little bit. It's just modifiers. But yeah, it's all about like sailing around and trying to shoot at the enemy ship from the front, or even better, from the back, for those like super devastating raking shots.
Trying to cross the T.
Yes, exactly.
Nice. So it has gunnery coffee tables, but like, so a little bit of looking up your guns and distances, but not too much.
Yeah, I feel like I need a cheat sheet just to get like what range of the different types of guns are and what the modifiers are and stuff like that.
That's a lot more fair for like a naval combat game with relatively few moving parts, right?
Yeah, you've got, you know, six ships aside, basically.
Yeah, I've realised that naval combat or spaceship combat, all the sort of... So your Armadas, your Battlefleet Gothics, they're the type of systems which I've never played before, but I feel I'm most in danger of. Of thinking, actually, I really would quite like to give that a go. I really do very much get the appeal of having a small fleet of ships of some variety and moving around and having quite that sort of manoeuvring and trying to line up shots and things being and ships being quite resilient at first, so you can sort of manoeuvre them around each other a bit and having to take account of tides and stuff. There's lots of things there which really appeal to me, I think. I'm not sure how much of this is actually an Armada, but every time I see a game which has some form of tiny ships, I think, is this the one I will get into? Yeah. And Armada is definitely one which is on my radar as that looks pretty nice.
If Battlefleet Gothic ever comes back, a lot of people are going to be in a lot of monetary danger.
That Battlefleet Gothic is my great lost cause. I never got it when I was young, and I'm regretting that. It's my big regret. I got more time instead.
Your white space whale.
Yeah.
The one that got away.
Yep.
The one that got away. Yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever tried Titanicus?
Me? Oh. Or you?
Tom.
I have played Titanicus. I played it actually, ironically, with my Imperial Knights. Imperial Knights as Warlords and a Redemptor Dreadnought as a Warhound, I think. Because it was approximately the right size. I do have Titanicus. I have a fair number of Titans that are in the pile of shame to do at some point because, yeah, it is, again, a game which I really think I would quite enjoy this.
Drew is very fond of comparing that to a, if I remember right, he's quite quite fond of comparing it to a naval combat game, right? Or at least other people are, if it's not Drew, sorry, but certainly some people.
It was me saying it like a day ago, but I was also, but I was being a bit sarky. Yeah, because I like being able to track, have a relatively small number of models on the table, but track each of them in detail. I think that's a very interesting balance to strike as compared to either a full combat game where you've got 1,000 things on the board or a skirmish game where you have 10 guys, but for each of them you're kind of just tracking like how many wounds they've got or something, right? I'm there's if you asked if you hired me for Games Workshop and asked me to make Battlefleet Gothic, I would start from the Titanicus rules and turn everything sideways so that it was longer than it was wide.
and then leave it.
Yeah, and
even the rule book.
You sure? Yeah, it's one of those rule books shaped like one of those kids learn to read books.
they actually were like quite wide though.
The Battlefleet Gothic rule book
was quite.
There we go then. They should hire me.
It's such a it's such a weird book that.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, circling actually back to the skirmish games, that's, I think, one of the things I like about Warcry, that I know it is just tracking wounds, but because they have more wounds per model, it does feel a bit, it feels like it's getting into a bit more of the, it's not just one wound and gone that you have in a lot of skirmish games. Yes. It's a, you do care about how wounded someone is, and okay, they've got just two or three wounds left. That's an issue, and you're actually making the calculation of, okay, I know that the enemy is likely to be able to do this much damage to them. I think they can survive that, and it gives a bit more granularity in that decision making, which, as I say, is a large part of the appeal for me. But it doesn't go as far as your Titanicus does in terms of tracking individuals, but it has that sort of that little bit of it, just a nibble.
My favorite thing in Warcry is like a fighter being left alive with like one wound, just like against the odds. Or second favorite thing, fighter dealing exactly enough damage to take out an enemy fighter.
Yes. Very satisfying. Yeah, nice. Okay, well, I think we should carry on to our topic. So as mentioned earlier, we're talking about terrain modularity. Tom, if you want to expand on what you meant by what you like to bring to the pod table.
Yes, so what I was wanting to, as I said, I've been playing quite a lot of Necromunda recently, and when I started the campaign, indeed, when I got the terrain, I was like, right, I've got all this Mechanicus terrain, it's great, it can be really modular, I don't glue any of it together, just build it as we go. And same with the Sector Mortalis terrain I've got, just set out as we go. And I quite really quickly realised how much of a faff that is. It's a lot of time to set up a board. And it's just got me thinking of trying to find the sweet spots between complete modularity of your terrain and complete fixed terrain boards. Because I mean, I've recently started infiltrating a local historical wargamers club, which has this is a bit of a tangent, but basically they've got the top floor of a local building is just exclusively, permanently, this wargames club. I could go there at 2 o'clock in the morning if I wanted to and just play on their tables there. And
it drives me nuts. I'm sorry to interrupt, but you've shown us photos of this place and it's just like, it's incredible to me that it exists.
Yeah, and I have a key to it. And if we ever want to do a rollout in Durham, just hit me up. We could go there and play Warhammer at midnight in this place.
I'd be up for that. Durham's not too far.
Yeah, it's an option. They have like eight 6x4 tables there.
Wow.
But what they've also got is that they've got, so some of their boards are things like a scale trench system, completely models. You can't really do much else with that board. It's just a trench system. They've got a scale model of Troy as a board.
Good grief.
Which has been clearly built by someone a couple of decades ago and is just there. And so that's one end of scale, and that's the same as the
sorry, at this point that archaeology is itself archaeology.
And it's but that's one of the scale. You've got your fully custom built, someone wanted a Siege of Troy game at some point and they built it, and they probably had a lot of fun doing that and built it. And the same as you get all the Warhammer worlds, boards, because those look fantastic to have set up. And you're right, I am playing on this very fixed board.
Yeah.
So that's one end of the scale. The other end of the scale is complete modularity, and all of my pieces are going to break down small and work out, and we'll work out what to do with them as we go. I think most gamers probably have their terrain collection somewhere in the middle of, they'll have them built as buildings, and you might be able to stack the buildings a bit, or you can arrange them around the board. I just sort of thought it'd be interesting to see what people's approaches and preferences were. I mean, with my Necromunda stuff, what I'm planning to do is get some 12-inch tiles and just start gluing terrain onto those, because then you can have the tiles, you have sort of like 9 of them to a board, and you can rearrange...
Yeah, you can mix up your tiles.
Yeah, you can rearrange them, but the tiles themselves are fixed. And I think that will be a good balance for Necromunda. I mean, the other thing is what we think about this, of course, is the latest, the boarding action stuff from 40K, which is very much, you have all of these walls, and you rearrange them based on the scenario, and from all accounts, that takes a while.
I will go fully batting for 100% modularity all the time, every day. I magnetized the Warcry terrain, and I really enjoy doing it, and it does, and there is an impact on setting the time it takes to set up, but I am scared that I would rapidly get bored if I had the same setup all the time. And even I like modular, so as a terrain hog, I have got a lot of terrain, right? But I have not painted it. But anyway, I'm modularizing the old terrain, which wasn't meant to be modularized. It was just, you know, they used to have a little hidden features in them that you were designed to just glue shut forever. So I'm like, no, I'm going to magnetize all of it. So I'm heavy into magnetizing. Even stuff like the fortified manor, which is technically just a chapel and a watchtower glued together by a little annex between the two. You know what? Magnetize all of it. So does you it, can just
does,
have...
Does it need to be magnetized? Like,
no, it absolutely doesn't, but I want to. because it wasn't designed to like clip together or anything.
Right. Yeah.
You kind of have to if you want it to like not knock it around. And the walls and the fences and the Sigmarite mausoleum spooky graveyardy stuff, and the fences for that, I'm going to make sense of all those bad boys. Because I want to just be able to set up whatever cool thing I want and even mix it. And when I've done this, you find that some bits are interchangeable. So like the Azurite ruins and the Warcry terrain are interchangeable if you cut them up in the right way and magnetize them in the right way. I think that's really cool. There's a trade-off. There is a trade-off. And if you're someone like me who doesn't play a lot of games, to be fair, I could probably just glue them all together and I would probably never notice and it would be fine, but the thought of it puts me off. So I like to modularize it.
Yeah, for me, an important consideration of modularity is about the capacity to pack it down and save space.
That's true.
Because I have the specific requirement that I'm probably not going to play very many games on my own terrain rather than at a club somewhere. So I need it to... The time to set up or change it is not a problem because I'm going to do that like the day somebody comes over, but the amount of space it takes up when I'm not using it is fine. And I've got a full boarding actions board that fits into the one of the kill team boxes.
Nice.
With a bunch of spare little bits of scattered terrain I've got that I think could allow me to expand that to a full Heresy Zone Mortalis board or nice. Necromunda if I wanted. And trying to get a full board like that worth of city ruins or something that I've glued together in some way, that would be a huge expenditure of space.
There is something so satisfying about being able to fit a board's worth of terrain into a box. And just go, that's my terrain.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what actually one of the things that you do with the Warcry stuff, because all the walls pack, it basically flat packs, apart from the bell tower. Yeah. It flat packs, which is really helpful.
It's one of the purest pleasures of hobby when something quite neatly fits into the box it came in after you've assembled it.
Hobby Tetris. Mm. Yeah, for sure. I can see benefits to both, but
I think the thing that always weirds me out is when people have a, like, they've just got like this one board and they can't really change the layout of it as such.
Yeah. Mm.
Like my favorite bit of starting a new war game, any game, could be Warcry, could be AOS, whatever, is just getting the terrain out and moving it around on the table until I'm like, yeah, that'll do. And you can't see that if you've got like a pre-built table, however beautiful it may be.
Mm. You lose the doll's house aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm very much, I think, with all of you on that, because I can definitely see the appeal of going to someone else's house or a wargaming club or Warhammer World and playing on a pre-made board, but making it for myself, I think the maximum level of fixed I would want is to have this 12-inch square Necromunda boards.
Mm.
Which are also a convenient size for using as 40k terrain, I reckon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
for sure.
But it's just odd because that's a step beyond what I would normally do. And because the other thing that I've been thinking about this space is for our upcoming campaign weekend. I've been messing around with a Playmobil castle to try and make some terrain for that.
Sorry, that took me a second to pass. I was like, did you say Playmobil?
Yes, I did say Playmobil. because it turns out that Playmobil castles and stuff are actually quite good war games terrain. If you sort of jazz them up a bit and put walkways and stuff on them. But the challenge I've been having is how fixed do I want to make this? Because I could, if I wanted to, make a wall to go across a table, and this is a fortress wall, and that is fixed, and that is a good, and I could make a really nice fortress wall for this, and if I want everyone to do a siege game, for example, that'd be great. But that's, it only has the one use. But if I make it into lots of smaller pieces, that's also useful because I can arrange them around the board as I want, however I want to. They can all be different things, and maybe have walkways to put between them, but it means that I can't do that wall so easily.
Hmm.
So it's sort of, yeah, it's just interesting trade-offs, really.
Yeah, it depends. If you're somebody who's got loads of space and you can store loads of stuff, I would in that instance do more fixed stuff, but where I can, and for reasons of storage is a really big one, and being able to pack stuff down when you can break it up essentially, and know that it will go back together happily. Essentially through modularization, then I would do that wherever I can. I think it's really satisfying working out how to, I like with the Warcry terrain, which is the big one I did, I really enjoyed working out how to have that in ways which were fully compatible, like, or as maximally compatible with different things as possible, you know, like working out common places to put magnets, so like the sort of the board planks which sit across the tops of the buildings can sit on any building, any walls that I've got, because they've all got the magnets in the right patterns all along the top and stuff. So that's, you know, and the challenge of figuring that out was satisfying in of itself. So
I'm really curious actually as to how you dealt with the staircases, because I found with
also magnetized
but working out where to put the magnets, because I found that with the with the Warcry terrain cards, they need you to not have glued all the terrain together and be able to put stairs in various places, but if you put the ruin on the board and put a staircase next to it, and then it just, and on the board it just slides off because there's no friction. So I need to work out where to put magnets on my
you
staircases.
Need small magnets and a fine pin vise drill bit.
Yeah,
that's what I'll say. And quite small magnets.
You'd have to put magnets like everywhere on the ruin, right?
There's a lot of magnets.
Oh god!
I mean, to be fair, it's not like fully. You can't put it literally anywhere because there are like certain set places where you're expected, these things expect to come in. Yeah. So it's not literally everywhere, but it's in like the common places. They all have.
I'd love to see this fully magnetized terrain set.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure I brought it to me. I'll bring it to everyone. Yeah, you can admire from afar.
I've never used it from afar.
Yeah, because I'll never use it. Well, I say from afar, I mean like unbuilt in its box. Play with it like it's Lego.
I mean, it's just reminded me actually of a thing I saw on. Shall we call rival website Go On Hammer?
They're a small indie outfit.
Never heard of them.
Get them to denounce us for the popularity.
I mean, they've approached other podcasts to have on their website, not us, honestly. But yeah, so Go On Hammer, as they do not prefer to be called. There was an article just the other day where someone was talking about having magnetized their kill team terrain, not their kill team, their boarding actions terrain, and that involves drilling out the parts of it, putting metal rods in them.
Oh wow!
And then putting magnets on the end of the walls as well.
I'm not sure that's necessary. I think I would like to try that because
that's
unnecessary.
Says
you
the
need
guy
to
who
do
magnetized
that.
Every aspect of the Warcry box.
Yep. Basically, I'm going to throw down that challenge. I think that person's ever done it. I'm sure it's
hear me
great.
Out. We just make half of the terrain out of magnet and half of the terrain out of some kind of ferrous material. Job done.
Perfect.
Yeah, yeah, we'll just break into Games Workshop and mould a metal version of the terrain.
Metal terrain, iron terrain.
Yeah.
That's what I want. Steel terrain. That's the only bit that matters.
Pre-magnetised terrain.
Yep, pre-magnetised steel terrain. Actually, you know what? Because they gave slots in Titanicus, right, for magnets, and it's my suspicion that they thought about that when they were doing the Warcry terrain, because there are very conveniently sized bits of adjoining terrain which have no like function other than as sort of, I suppose, gluing surfaces, but they are very conveniently sized for magnets, and you know, I'm just like, well, that's. Curious why they would put those there when they are the perfect size and location for magnets.
I think you answered your own question when you said gluing surfaces.
All right, but hear me out. It could be. All right, fair.
I feel that there's this point in every hobbyist's time with wargaming stuff where they learn about magnets and then it becomes, I can magnetize this. I can magnetize this. I can magnetize this. And it is just a sort of a massive development step in a hobbyist's type. Once you start magnetizing, you don't go back.
I sort of
when
admire and shake.
It's a magnet. Everything looks like another magnet.
Everything looks like a steel rod. Yeah. I kind of admire the people who sort of magnetize their Space Marines' wrists and stuff like that. Like, it's absolute insanity to me, but I do, you know, I do appreciate it.
Yeah.
I like a sort of crazed mid-19th century artist, like, generating incredible works, but at what cost?
Yeah. It's like the people who put LEDs in their models. That is,
it's
really impressive. It's like, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Certainly something that people do.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of effort.
Yeah, once you put an LED in a model, every model looks like you could have an LED in it, and you're lost forever.
Yeah. Grand. Okay. So we also wanted to talk lizards, because I don't know, I shamefully confess to have not listened to the 21st People Pods, but I don't know if they've discussed lizards at length, but I'm going to do it. If they have, sorry, you can do it again. If they haven't, well, lizards, huh? They're certainly back. Tom.
Sure going to be some good lizards, aren't there?
There's going to be some good lizards. I've been collecting the lizard boys since about 2018. Before they were like, before people appreciated that they were brutally overpowered. I was collecting them before that. I want to get that in in speaking. And I've loved the lizards from the beginning. And this refresh is, I think, long overdue. They had some of the, I don't know about the oldest, but they certainly had some of the oldest models in Age of Sigmar.
Yep.
and they have had for a while.
You are lucky that I do not no longer have the box of old models from my childhood by my desk, because I was about, if I did, I'd have pulled out a circa 96 Lizard Man.
Yeah.
And gone, you child, you've been collecting them since 2018.
Oh, no, I had them too.
Yes.
I had
okay, the old guys. There we go.
But they're long gone. But the summer, I still have like some really old priests and the skink priest, like old skink priest. Not the guy with the skaven, the guy with the skull on his head holding a little Indiana Jones crystal skull.
Mm.
That's a good skink, that is. But the new ones, it's a big refresh. It's here, the new Seraphon, new Battle Tome. I bought the new books, got the new Battle Tome. The new Battle Tome is really good, not just for rules, which it is fun for, but in terms of lore. The lore is excellent in there. It's really solidifying or coalescing into something pretty nice.
I've not read the new lore yet, but one thing that has really impressed me, because I only recently got any of the new third edition battle tomes, and all of the ones I've read so far seem like a real general step up in quality from the second edition. They just feel like more premium products. Something about it, the kind of thing that people who are very good at making good books could talk at length about, but me, the dipshit consumer, I'm just going, ooh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Something about the layout and the spacing really works well, I think. It's
good. The lore is. I feel like the lore it genuinely is solidifying. So in the first Seraphon Battle Tome, I think they're a bit like, what do we do with these? We'll just call them space lizards. Made of light, and they sort of turn about, and that was okay. Right? It's pretty freeform. It was not much to go on, but that was a very early OS thing that
AOS era of
where are the farmers? Yeah.
They've got to rewrite all of
to make this fit
all of the lore all at once. Uh-huh. And there's a couple of armies that get done at 5 PM on a Friday.
Yeah, I don't know if it was necessarily that, but it was for sure like, what the fuck do we do with all the lists?
Yes.
And that was fine. The second edition one, sorry, I won't. Second AOS Battle Tome was a bit better because they started to flesh out a little bit, but it was still the same idea of like, oh, they just sort of live in the sky, and it was okay, and they were, or maybe they live, maybe there's a few of them who sort of live in the jungles and blah blah blah. And the third one, they've
The second edition one introduced the Golast, I think.
Oh yeah, you're right. I did. I'm a complete moron.
Because they were like, okay, we've been telling everyone they're just memories, and then people don't really like that. So now we have the option of they can be actual inhabitants of the realms.
Yeah. So, but my recollection of that is it's quite light on the sort of lore side of what that really means.
And yeah.
But anyway, the third one is which is like full on. Yeah, like skinks live in the cities and they do these jobs and they do those jobs and Saurus do this and they do that and here is how they work and here is how Coalesce work and this is some weird things that can happen. And it just really opens it up and it's kept it flexible, but it really gives you a lot more grounding onto what their jam is basically. And it's really nice. And you get like a few like stories, like little, I think maybe this is a new thing in the new Battle Tomes, but you get little cut out stories and stuff. And they're only like a paragraph long, but they're just nice. Like, you know, the Saurus, the Croxigor saving the skink and just little bits. They're just nice.
That's nice. Cause like I said, I haven't read new one, but one thing that I had trouble with with a previous Battle Tome was, what is a skink like to talk to?
Exactly.
I get what they do, but what are they like personally?
I guess the last one felt like it was written about Seraphon, right?
Yes.
So by like other people, which is of course it all literally is that, but in the third one you feel like it's from the Seraphon is coming from within the temple ship.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, you are you're getting the Seraphon perspective on these things.
And that's an interesting.
Like, this is what we as Seraphon are trying to do, and it's much more interesting and cool. And you're like, all right, that's their goals. Like, that's what they're trying to do. That's how they live, and that's what they think. And blah blah blah. Yeah, it's just nice, much more characterization, really.
Because that's the faction.
Are there any Black Library books?
There aren't.
That are about or with the Seraphon.
No, I don't think as primary characters. No.
Occasionally they prop up as. Yep. You know, this ex machinas or just like, just beasts. But yeah, there aren't any yet that are about their perspective, which I think is a shame.
Yeah, I mean, I think because I think the Seraphon are a really cool concept. How they've ended up. I mean, I really liked them in Warhammer Fantasy as well. I think they're really my very first introduction to the hobby was a white dwarf with a lizard man on the front, and I was like, oh, that looks cool. I've always liked the lizard man. I've never collected them myself particularly, but they've always. And I think the Starforged or
the Starborn.
I quite like that as a concept. Mm. But I feel the biggest problem with Seraphon as they are in Age of Sigmar is Stormcast Eternals.
The biggest problem with Seraphon is Stormcast Eternals.
Yes, because the Starforged or Starformed or Starborn. That's very much in the same space as the Stormcast Eternals, and then being the sort of almost the demon equivalent of Order.
Yeah.
Compared to Chaos Demons.
Yeah.
They had the demon keyword, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They did.
Yeah.
They were literally Order Demons for a good while.
Yeah.
So that has changed now with this third edition one. You still have that, but it's very clearly different.
Yeah. So
like the context of them being Azir touched or whatever is very different from the Stormcast now.
Yeah, but I feel for early AOS had two factions which were mighty warriors forged by the gods descending from the skies in the name of order. Yeah. You had two factions like that, and one of them was supposed to faction and the other was Seraphon.
Yeah.
And that's a real shame because I'm really pleased that they're now starting to get their own identity again and being their own thing and having lots of really fun, interesting models because they are one of the more unique things in Warhammer settings, I think. There aren't. I mean, you do get lizard men in various other contexts, but not as a major force in the same way as you have.
Well, the lizard men as they characterize in AOS are very unique to AOS, really. And they sort of it's just interesting. Even then, so they have the same thing of like they can be star. They're living in fucking spaceships essentially, and they're like teleporting down and. Crunching chaos, but even that the context is completely different. They still keep it quite vague in that you know the slan that and they sort of there is not I was gonna say it's subtext but it's not really it's basically just text that says they basically don't really know what they're doing anymore and they're kind of just winging it and they're basically like we have this vague urge to do to fight chaos but what that entirely means we sort of appreciate that we've mostly forgotten and we don't really know so we're just gonna try and work it out and that's just that just leaves it open too. So they don't have the sort of Stormcast, right? Well, ultimately, we're trying to destroy chaos, and so Stormcast kind of have the same thing. But the Stormcast are human, right? Essentially, so they don't have, or mostly human. So they have that grounding, whereas the Lizardmen is much more calculating, and how they go about it can be sort of justifiably completely different. I still think they're interesting, basically, even though they do actually share similarities with the sort of Stormcast narrative.
I also do wonder if part of the inspiration for the Starborn thing, the turning them into dream lizards, was moving away from the fairly dodgy tribal aesthetic.
I don't know though. They've leaned into that more than ever.
Yeah. But was that the original conception when they first came out? When they were like, okay, we've got these models, we've got a chance to rewrite the lore. Do we want to? Because they have stopped doing the pun names.
Yeah, they did that, but they've lent into the Aztec and sort of Native Central American and South American themed like more than ever.
Hmm.
I think it's really cool. So like I'm not qualified to comment on it really, but it looks dope. So, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not great, but the you know, from in
yes,
terms
yes,
of
I'm not,
the
I'm
lore
not,
is to be fair, the lore is completely detached. From
I
that.
Come to praise lizards, not to cancel
I think as a, I mean, you'll probably correct me if I'm wrong, but they've lost. They've no longer got some certain aspects which are the sort of almost the sort of conquistador propaganda of what they're like. So I'm not aware of any sort of like sacrificing as a major element, which was a thing you had in Liz Mangard, or is there? Is there?
That's come back.
Has that come back? Okay.
Yeah. The skinks get a little bit sacrificial sometimes, especially the coalesced ones.
Yeah.
They go back into that. But that's, I mean, that's old lore of lizard men as well. So it's, you know.
Okay, so they haven't.
What else would the skink do? The skink, because the thing is, the skinks are duality where they're sort of they're smart, but also they are weedy and they will throw themselves. They will quite happily sacrifice themselves for certain things. And they,
I mean, sacrificing prisoners and stuff, that sort of style thing.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
Are they still doing the Aztec style ritual on a big pyramid?
No, so it's literally a couple of lines that are like, you know, they do some sacrificial ceremonies. It's not much more. Okay.
Yeah,
it doesn't go into the whole.
That's the sort of stuff I think is quite far off. They didn't have that aspect, because that's
so that's, I say it's not like a main theme, but it's mentioned in the book, so it's not as if it's gone away. I think it's, to be fair, it's probably best described as a nod back to the old stuff, and they haven't written it out. They've acknowledged that it exists, and they go, yeah, I think it's probably GW saying, you know what, if you want to have like your like crazy sacrificial old skinks that, you know, pray Sotek and cut hearts out of Skaven, then go for it,
go ahead.
Yeah, so that's probably what I read that as, is, you know, for better or worse. But skinks, you know, but the skinks, everything gets developed more. The saurus are more developed. The skinks are more developed. The croxibor are more developed. So they can be much more as well. So it's really interesting. I really enjoyed reading the lore in this more than I have in the last two battle turns of this. So I'm super up on it. And the models are incroyable. They're so good. It's a shame to lose the priests, but I mean, so they've done some consolidation of things. We've got rid of skink priests, don't exist anymore. Kind of boo, because I have all the really nice skink priests.
I mean,
great models,
those are some of the best models from the older range. It's a shame,
but they're gone. It's all star priests and star seers now. But all the models are absolutely fantastic. So what are you gonna do? The Slan model that I've built is so complicated. It's a properly like advanced model. It's a bit of a pain to build, but it's really nice. And the new Saurus, fantastic. Well, the one notable thing about the models is Saurus Guard have not been updated, and that's mad.
I do like how they're on the same page of the battle scrolls, of the battle tome, so you can look from shiny new Saurus down to their
dorky,
rickety older brothers.
Yeah. They don't look great. I mean, I won't convert any because I can't be asked. But you could. I think actually, you know, I think GW should lean into that thing they've been doing recently of doing like an upgrade sprue. Because all you'd need, because the new Saurus models are quite armored, all you would need is new shields, new heads, and new weapons.
What?
And that would be fine.
So I've still got my 10 new Saurus to do.
Mm-hmm.
What if I gave the new Saurus the old shields, and then later on can pick up some more new Saurus and give them the new shields, and because I've got 10 Saurus Guard waiting to go, and give them the new shields and the Saurus Guard weapons. I wonder if that would work.
So give the old shield.
I've got 10 warriors that I want to make into warriors. If I give them the old shields, the lizard skin shields, right, that the old models have, then would that be enough of a distinction that the next box I get, I give them the shiny new metal shields?
No, the shiny metal shields, they're quite bland. I think you could convert the shiny metal shields by gluing some bones and gluing some skulls to them and gluing some of the old... So one of the things, you don't get as many, like, ribbony, streamery bits as you used to with the old... God. Well, you say thank God, but I think they're really nice little decorations. You just don't get them anymore. Them. Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true. But the, you know, the old Saurus Guard shields were very extra, and these ones are not. So if you extra them up...
Yeah.
The other thing is that the pole arms will be a pain because all these spears are, like, pointing forward like bloody Lumineth warden things. So they're going to be a bit of a sort of spaghetti mess in your, however you store them.
Or try using them.
So I don't know.
Can't just do a hand swap.
The arms are outstretched. I think it'd be quite difficult.
Sure. Yeah.
I like that we've ended up on the classic Warhammer suggestion of just glue some more skulls on it.
Yeah, just glue some more skulls on it. Because to be fair, the old Saurus Guard literally just have like lots of skulls on there. One of the defining things was having a massive skull on their head. Like wearing an animal skull over their crest, and I think that, like, come on, it would be insanely good. That could look so awesome. So I just think they need an upgrade spree. It's my throwdown challenge to GW. That, or just get rid of Saurus Guard. Like, just people would be sad, but just use them as Saurus Warriors and be done with it. People will moan, but I don't care. That's my take. I'm very excited for the new lizards. Oh, and the new Velociraptors. Very good. I hope the new carnosaurs are good. I haven't tried them yet. I have to paint all this stuff before I give it a go. Croak is still busted. Fully busted.
I played a game with the new carnosaur.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah, nice.
Does very good work. Even into Nighthaunt, who ignore his lovely rend.
They can't take inspired leadership or whatever, right? Inspired presence.
Yes.
Inspiring presence when
he's
around.
Yeah, so they have the... Yeah, that's useful, particularly for the fighty carnosaur rather than the leady carnosaur.
Yeah.
Who gets bonus mortal wounds on partially wounded but alive enemies.
Yeah.
So you can charge in and try and finish off any models that you have not quite got and encourage them to run away.
Yeah. Although that's a bit weird though, because if it's a big unit of small wound models that you want to run away, you probably aren't going to have many wounds left over to roll models on.
I guess I'm thinking of it as being quite useful for pushing over into one more model into a unit like... something fairly big like dragons or blight lords or something
that,
right?
Yeah,
where
for sure.
you
force them to take
fail
that
battle shock by one for it to be a big deal, and your opponent would be sitting on a command point to keep them around.
Yeah, that's true. Or if you can, yeah, that's true. Interesting. Or if you can hit them with another, I'm not sure the mortals necessarily combos with the inspiring presence block, but certainly if you can get the carnosaur to tag a unit which has been bopped by something else, is going to have to take that big old test, then you're off to the races.
I've got to check the rules as to whether you, because I assume you don't necessarily need to do it against the people you fought. It doesn't need to be your wounds.
No, I think it's just units within three or whatever can't take inspiring presence.
I mean in terms of the additional
the additional
damage.
Thing, yeah, who knows.
Yeah.
What are you two talking about?
This is lizard tactics.
It's just gone down like a rules hole.
Oh, yeah. No, we're here. This is it. We've got to find ways to make Seraphon bust.
Yeah, we're renaming the podcast Tying Plastic Seraphon.
Oh, yeah. Okay, let's do that. I'm down for that. You know, that's really made that decision. Rachel, do you find war games relaxing?
Just on the topic of lizards, I really like Seraphon. I think they're great.
That's a very good opinion.
I've got some, but not any of the new ones or whatever. And I don't expect I'll be doing an army of them anytime soon. But
that's a really good opinion.
I'm very happy for you all.
Thank you.
You have to get the skink Starseer, who looks like he is on the toilet.
He's just
really looking forward to getting that model.
The old one was pretty good as well.
Yeah.
So my topic was about basically like play board games to relax. Does the concept of relaxation even like remotely overlap with playing miniature war games for you? Because this is something I've been thinking about recently, and like playing Kings of War last weekend really solidified it for me, where I think it's a combination of things where like recently I've been playing Age of Sigmar, and because that's been for the League, and it's been in a venue I'm not hugely fond of because of like it's quite noisy and difficult to hear and it takes a little bit for me to get to and then get back from, it's just like there's a bit of stress there, and then I'm playing like a stranger and they're, you know, I'm worried about if they're like forgetting the rules or kind of messing up or whatever, or like I'm worried about how I'm playing and like I'm trying to win but I don't feel like I can or whatever and stuff like that. And I'm like trying to keep on top of all of these rules, and like there's just so many things I need to remember to do in my turn and in the opponent's turn and stuff like that. And finding that all just a bit quite stressful. Mm-hmm. Or not even like stressful, maybe just kind of overwhelming or
intense.
Not relaxing, in other words.
I think it's not relaxing.
And then playing Kings of War, it's like super streamlined, and I would get to the end of my turn in like 3 minutes, if that, and just be like, and granted, this is a very small scale, small points level game, but still, and just being like, wow, is that it? And also, the person I was playing against, turns out she's really nice. We just like really quickly developed a rapport, and we obviously both have similar priorities in what we're looking for in gaming. So yeah, and I think that really solidifies something for me, where it's like this should be something that I do to relax, maybe. But I'd never, up until that point, I'd never like consciously thought in the middle of playing a game, oh, I'm relaxing while I do this.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever been relaxed while playing a war game, frankly. And yeah. Not that that's a bad thing for me. You enjoy it, but you enjoy the stress of pushing myself and thinking, well, not pushing myself, but like thinking about it and being involved in it and being invested in all the stuff. And I think that is, for me, necessarily detached from relaxing. But I'm okay with that.
Because when you brought it up when I first saw that you put this subject in the Discord, my instinctive reaction was, well, of course I do. Of course I do. I like doing it. I get a bit stressed out if I go without playing for that for too long. Of course it's fun. Hang on a second, is it? And like, I think maybe it's not, actually. I think you're right in that there are plenty of good ways to spend your time that you enjoy that do relax you, but also that's not the only route to enjoyment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
you can be enjoying something without being relaxed.
Yes. Like obviously if you're playing football or whatever, like that's not relaxing, but you enjoy doing it.
Yeah.
So
I think
sorry, do you want to finish that thought?
Sure. I think it is the kind of thing that it's relaxing to get to do it even if it's not in the moment, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's actually pretty much what I was gonna say. I think that that's a good lead in, because what I was going to so his challenge philosophically is, what do we mean by relaxing? And I think that the measure of relaxation is not necessarily how you feel in the moment, which, as people have been saying, quite rightly saying, there'll be times where you're stressed and times you think, oh, I'm having to think a lot of thinking and I've spent a lot of mental energy on this. It's how you feel afterwards. It's do you feel it has had a an overall net positive on your mental state, on your state of relaxation? Think, yes, I've had a good time. I'm somewhat, you know, I might be tired, but I'm tired in a nice way. I'm not stressed out over the result of it. I don't, because I think you know, it's quite possible for a game not to be relaxing, and you come out thinking, oh, I've made so many mistakes. I've had a terrible time. I don't feel I fully understood. And that's actually where I feel that 9th Edition 40K is for me, for example, that there's so much stuff going on. I feel that when I get to the end of a game, I am tired and I think I've had fun, but I'm not necessarily feeling relaxed.
There's a difference between having been relaxed and having enjoyed yourself, and they're separate. Sometimes related, but not necessarily two things.
Whereas after a game of Warcry, I might have had quite a lot of thinking about it. I might have had quite a lot of tactics, but I've had a fun time. And at the end, I think, that was a good way to spend my evening. And I would count that as relaxation. And taking it off to a completely different hobby, I do live action role play. And there's some games I've been to where I think I've got to the end of the week and I think I'm really stressed out by this. By everything that's happening in the game, everything that's happening in the world, and I'm not relaxed. And actually, I need a few days to recover from that, not just from physical exhaustion, but from emotional exhaustion. And is that relaxing? Not really. I think it's... I mean, in the answer of, are war games relaxing, it's... they can be, and a lot of the time they probably should be, but don't necessarily, because if you're going for a tournament and you're actually trying to get the... you know, you're getting satisfaction from victory and from crushing your opponents beyond you. That's an entirely different goal. It's making sure you know when your goal is to be relaxed and when your goal is to you stretch yourself competitively. When you and all sorts of other goals that you can have in war games, and it's a tool to achieve that.
So the answer is. Yes, and also no.
Yes.
And also yes.
Yeah.
And also no.
And maybe.
And also maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an open box. Anyway, make your choice.
Yeah. I think my choice is that I want
to
try.
It's up to you.
I will try and pursue that, like, wargaming zen, where it's just gonna... Yes. I'm just chilled out.
You can enjoy anything you want. It's up to you.
The wise wargamer understands... that it's not.
War Games Day is treat day. Nice.
Grand. On that little bit of philosophy that we've introduced.
I have to go fulfill my civic duty. Oh, you, in fact.
Putting the exact date on where we're recording this. How could you?
Do we quickly want to hit the oven thing before we go?
Oh, the oven thing. Yeah, go. All right. Someone else explain. Someone else explain the oven thing, yeah?
No, you take responsibility for your actions.
All right, I did it. I once thought, I've got some PVA on my bases to dry, right? You know, you got some, you're getting the PVA out, you're making some bases. It's winter, going to take a while to dry, PVA, very watery glue.
Dane's cooked his models. We can't listen to the print.
Gently,
he cooked, he
gently
fucking
sauteed.
Cooked his models.
What temperature?
Well, apparently too much. too much temperature. I will say, I did it once, and it worked. And the second time, if you've ever seen a Stormcast bend at the shins, that photo exists, I'll say that.
They were the converted Seraphon Stormcast, weren't they?
A couple of them, yeah.
It's absolute tragedy.
And the bases turned into Pringles. Well, you know, try anything once. Or twice, apparently. On that fantastic note.
That is when war games are not relaxing.
Yeah. Tell me about it. Okay, well, let's bring this hot flaming ship to harbour. So you can find Tiny Plastic People at tinyplasticpeople.com Tom F, where can people find you?
You can find me at LeSwordfish on Twitter, so that's L-E Swordfish, all one word. I'm also on co-host under that same name, or Instagram at L-E underscore Swordfish.
Nice. Rachel, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Nershly, N-E-R-S-H-L-Y, or on Twitter at Rachel Nersha, which is just Rachel, N-E-R-T-I-A.
Nice. Tom G, where people find you?
You can find me on Instagram as Respectable Geek.
Nice. And I'm on all good social medias. That's not true at all. There are none.
Tumblr!
T-N-
There's Tumblr!
T- I stand by what I said. They're at TN Dines. You can email us any questions, any hot questions at thetinyplasticpeople@gmail.com. That's all from me. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye.